Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Leading the Way Radio Show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Good afternoon and welcome to Women Lead Radio, brought to you by Connected Women of Influence. I'm Joni Cannell, your host for Real Life Lessons. This is a very special day for us because it's our first episode of Real Life Lessons. This series focuses on real women who speak about what it takes to be successful in the real world. The lessons are not from any leadership textbook. They're from women's experiences. We're here to learn about how successful women handle those unanticipated aspects of work that no one prepared us for. We work off the real life model, R-E-A-L, because women need to be resilient, empowered, authentic, and limber to succeed in the workplace. Well, let's move into our show. With me today is our leading lady, Margaret Grossman, a.k.a. Margaret Stevens. She's the retired editor-in-chief at Executive Publications, where she managed three editions of The Executive magazine. Good afternoon, Margaret.
Hello. How are you, Joni?
I'm so doing well. How are you?
Quite well.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much for being our first real-life leading lady. Our topic today is real life lessons from a curvy climb up the publishing industry. Now, speaking of curvy, Margaret, you started working as a fashion model in London and Paris. Let's start there.
Yes, well, it really was an advertising model. You know, I did things like British Airways when it was BOAC and Evian Water, and also, you know, household situations where we had to look glamorous housewives in those days. And that started in, I would say the late 50s, just beginning of the 60s. And when you go back to that time, you have to realize, and very few young women today would even believe, that women were not encouraged to go to a university. If you went to a university, you were usually referred to as a blue stocking and a spinster, because there were a lot less reasons that you would be able to get married and really get onto your career, i.e. your husband's career. So there wasn't a lot of choice. My father said, well, darling, you can be an air hostess, which is now what we call, we call it something else now. You can be a executive secretary, or you could be a mannequin. And not one of those appealed to me because, particularly as I didn't even fancy walking along stages dressed in all these clothes and backwards and forwards, which is what we did then. We didn't have music and we didn't dance on the stage either. So I went into advertising modeling really by luck. I just looked through a book, a Yellow Pages sort of thing in England, and I saw the model agencies, and I chose the least well-known, because I didn't have any confidence, and I thought, well, this one's not so well known, so maybe it's the one I should apply to first. And they took me on right away, gave me some quite nice jobs, and I realized I'd really hit the right thing, because they didn't handle the very high fashion things, which I would not have been suitable for, was not tall enough. And I did a lot of traveling with this. It paid my rent. But I always knew it wasn't the be-all and end-all of anything. It just wasn't for me. I mean, you always did what you were told. You weren't really given any leeway to be creative or to think. So that journey was my beginning, and that was in London. And then after a while, I went to Paris for various personal reasons. A marriage was included in that. And I found that you could not legally belonged to an agency that charged fees for giving you the jobs, which, of course, everyone did, commission. So you had to almost do it illegally in Paris at that time. I mean, it was a very reputable model agency, but you didn't ever, ever do it overtly. You had to give them the money quietly, sort of under the table. So that's the second part of my story. And the third part is really when I moved to New York, and New York was my place. That is where I had opportunity.
Let me stop you for a second, because I'm just really curious. You talked about being a model, and you know, you said it wasn't your be-all, end-all. Did you have goals? I mean, what were you thinking when you did this?
No, not really. I think, actually, it was a lot of fun. I have to say, although we worked hard, it was a swinging 60s. I mean, it was the beginning of Vidal Sassoon. It was his hairdos. He cut my hair the first time. I mean, he used to cut models' hair for very little money when he first started. Mm-hmm. And it was the time of the Beatles had just started off, and we were all wearing short skirts, Mary Quant skirts. And for the first time in our lives, we didn't have to wear suspenders, what we call, I don't know what you call them here, things that hold your stockings up. We call them suspenders. Mm-hmm. Or garter belts, I believe you call them here.
Right.
And we started wearing pantyhose. We were the first people to wear it, I think. And all of that was a lot of fun, and we felt we were on the cusp of things. And quite frankly, you know, that's really what it was about at that time. I never thought of it as something that would take me anywhere else. And it was a job that I could do and pay my rent. And that's basically what it was.
Well, you also told me previously that you were doing some writing at that time, because your curvy climb up the publishing industry moves into actually doing writing, not just modeling. How did that happen?
Well, that happened in New York. I mean, I didn't.
Okay.
I mean, I did write one thing for the BBC for a woman's program, and it was called Christmas in Sweden, because I happened to have spent several Christmases in Sweden, and they do very special Christmases. So I sent that into, it was Woman's Hour, and they took it. I don't know what happened to it afterwards, but they took it. And that was really the only thing I did at the beginning in London. But when I got to New York, I lived in Greenwich Village, and I found myself around incredible women, incredibly creative, feminist women, where it was starting off. I mean, it was very early on. If you think about the late 70s, it really wasn't, believe it or not, all that established. I mean, there were very, very definite lines with married women. And I know that all of the friends of mine who became feminists, every single one got divorced. And I know the ones that chose to stay and not, you know, and I mean, I still worked in the home. Obviously, I cooked and took care of children. But that the ones that stayed out of feminist activities stayed married. It was the most extraordinary time, because I could really see where it changed. And today, no one thinks of it. I mean, nobody thinks of it really at all. I mean, it was also equal pay for equal work was one of the things that we really, really pushed for.
Well, that's so interesting, because you bring up today's issue would be work-life balance and women working in the workplace and also taking care of the household and children. And how did you manage that?
Well, I only started part-time. I had a European husband who definitely did not really like any of this. So I was lucky in a way. I knew a lot about theatre. I'd been to the theatre since I was a child, and we're talking good theatre. We're talking the old Vic, and we're talking some of the English greats in terms of acting. You name them. I saw them at one time or other on the stage at the old Vic. It was the training ground, really. So I happened to live in Greenwich Village. I happened to have a friend who worked at a little Greenwich Village newspaper called The Villager, and she had been reviewing Broadway theatre, She had been trying to interview off-Broadway theatre, because it really hadn't got going either. It was just starting off. Things like The Roundabout really weren't at all established, and the public theatre had just sort of got going. And So she was given the job of going to do Broadway, and so she asked if I would like to do the job of off-Broadway, and I can't say there was a horde of people galloping after that because no yeah. one really knew. Some of it took place in places in, you know, took place in a garage, and some of it took place in nice theaters. It was just lucky. But what I got out of that was incredible because it was, you met all these new avant-garde writers. You met some of the actors that now are household names. I mean, it was unbelievable. But at the same time, when I started, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. The first thing I had to do was go to one of the more established theaters and see a performance of Moby Dick. So it was a mm-hmm. very long play. And so I thought I should do a very long review. So I put it in. It was my first one. Didn't hear back, not at all. And it should have been in the following week in the paper, but it wasn't. So then I plucked up courage to ask why. And so they said, well, it was a little bit long. We just had to do a bit of cutting. I mean, it went in. But we had to do a bit of cutting. So that's how inept I was, that, you know, I didn't look at the page and see how much room these things take. I just didn't. I mean, I had never done it before, and I didn't know the mores of space and advertising and all that sort of thing. Anyway, so that's how I started with that. And then I went on to do freelance articles and so on.
Well, I'm hearing a couple themes here in what you've said so far. First of all, you didn't really know what you were doing, and so you went and started out with a modeling in the least well-known agency, and you started off-Broadway reviews to get your foot in the door, but then you quickly moved up once you made a few mistakes and stuck with it. There's a very resilient woman here. And then you moved into some editing positions. And I'm wondering, like, this is moving into leadership. You went from writing now to actually leading other people as the editor. How did you learn these leadership skills? Did you have training?
Well, with the magazines, you see, I had started doing freelance articles because I realized that I had one part of knowledge that not many writers at that time, I'm not talking about now, not many writers really knew a lot about fashion and beauty. They just didn't in those days. We had no internet. You know, we didn't have that. So they didn't know a lot about that. And I realized I knew a bit about fashion and beauty. So I started approaching, I approached the editor at the time of Harper's Bazaar, never met the woman ever. I just looked her up on the masthead. And believe me, mm-hmm. I'm a very shy person. This is not easy for me to do things like that. And I thought, I said, is it possible to have an interview to talk about some articles that I think might fit your magazine? And she said yes. So I sat down at my desk and I thought of over 30 ideas. And so I took over 30 ideas up to this young editor who hadn't been on the job too long. And I think she was really stuck for ideas. And so she looked them all up and down. And then she gave me a cover story for an issue, and the whole issue was going to be on the theme of what I had suggested. It was actually, I think, about women at 40, which seemed like to many people, you know, gone past everything. Women at 40 and you know, the glamour and the ability of women at 36 and women at 40 and their careers and so on. It was sort of avant-garde at the time. And so they did a whole magazine thing on that. And she gave me the cover story. And then she said, just casually, oh, and it's all right if I keep these others, isn't it? And so I realized
30,
that the
29,
switch was I got the cover story, but she took yes. So once I got the hang of that, I was able to get into several magazines and do freelance articles. And so I saw, you know, I observed how magazines worked. I was very thrilled to go into a tall building and go into editorial offices, and it was quite exciting for me. And I looked around, I saw how I sort of got to see the layout of things. I just picked up what was needed. And I also, by that time, had some friends in the publishing industry who gave me help. I mean that I would have them look over my ideas, my things, and what I was doing, and they would tell me when, you know, I was really off base with something. So I had help. I always had help from friends.
Well, this is great. Yeah, I'm going to summarize here and say you learned by observing, and you learned by doing a lot. So you took the risks, and you made the phone calls. You walked into these high-rise buildings and had meetings with people that were very powerful and came up with great creative ideas. And at the same time, you had your support network, and you took the feedback. When they weren't good ideas, you would take the feedback and modify and make changes to go back and do it again. Does that sound like a good summary here?
Yes, it's rather a flattering summary, but yes, that's basically the truth. And, you know, I loved doing it. I felt for the first time, really for the first time in my life, that, you know, actually my ideas mattered. The people actually read what I thought about. And it was a really, really big thrill to do this. It wasn't always easy. I mean, they often gave freelance writers generally some of the more difficult things to do. The staff didn't mm-hmm. do the difficult ones. They did the glamorous ones. So I got stuck one day with something called lab annotation. Very few people know what that is, and I certainly didn't know when I was given the idea for the story, and someone said, all right, I want a whole story on what's happening in lab annotation in New York. Well, I found out it's the same thing as, and many of you may know it, but I didn't know it. It's the same way that you write music with the symbols and things. You do the same thing with classical dance, and I didn't know that. I had to go that far back, and no one else wanted to do it anyway. I mean, it was sort of not terribly thrilling subject. So you got things like that once in a while. But then I always had that in my book. And then I got something from Popular Mechanics, which is basically a book for a magazine for men. And so I had been always interested in archaeology, and I happened to be involved in some digs with Fordham University by chance. And so I went out to try to sell the idea of a book of an article on archaeology. What we were doing now, it was a very interesting story because it was an area in New Jersey where they were going to flood the whole area to make a dam. And so it turned out that this happened to be the area where some of the first indigenous people lived. And it goes back so far. I believe it was 5,000 years or something a long, long time. And so I had been digging there with my whole family every weekend because we had a country house near there. And so I thought this was a really interesting story. Well, of course, none of my fashion and women's magazines were particularly interested. So I went to Popular Mechanics, which is basically was about mechanical things and stuff for men. And they took it. And it's two of the things in my book I love to show, the lab annotation and the urban archaeology thing, because they gave me an assignment where they wanted to include urban, which meant old factories and things. And I can remember mm-hmm. trekking over this landscape of dilapidated factories, you know, to examine what had happened there in the beginning when they were first put up in the industrial era. And so it was always an experience. It was always an adventure, some better than others.
That sounds so interesting. So I'm hearing it also, it wasn't always glamorous, and you took positions and assignments that weren't the best, but you made it work, and then you took your creative ideas to other places to get them in there where you wanted them as well. Let me take a break for a second here, because some people might be really interested in getting a hold of you, especially hearing how much writing you've done. And I'd like to ask you, if our listeners want to reach you after the show, and particularly to hear about this novel I hear you're writing, how would you like our listeners to contact you?
Yes, I've been in the middle of that for a little while. Very dear to my heart, by the way, this book. does cover a large period from the 1900s right up to the late 50s, and takes place mm-hmm. in India, in Paris, in London. Many of my own experience I've woven into it, and it's very dear to my heart, this book. But if anyone needs to reach me, it's Margaret, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, 310, at me.com.
Oh, that's great. Margaret310 at me.com. So if you want to get in touch with Margaret after the show, that's how to reach her. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your leadership roles. First of all, you told me this fantastic story a while back about bringing in a first weekly magazine into America. Was Women's World?
Yes, but you skipped a little bit. I think if we went a little in order, because before that, because it doesn't make sense unless I tell you what happened before that, because I didn't just get to that. That was later, and that was really much bigger time than the freelance writing. And what I have been doing with the freelance was I did quite a lot for a magazine called Q Magazine, which became New York Magazine. And at the time, I became a contributing editor, and I had a column. They gave me a column. It wasn't a very interesting column. It was basically about shopping, which was not really my thing, but it was a column, and that was important to be a columnist. But I was also a contributing editor and did a lot of the stories, sometimes cover stories. And the publisher of that magazine at the time had the very first idea. It had not been done, as far as I know, before, because cable was only coming into being. I mean, cable only went as far as when we decided to do this, that we were going to have a show and put it on cable and just have the guests, some people who were quite often very famous from these articles, on our show talking about the articles before the magazine was published. It was a bi-weekly. So before it was published, we would have these people on, and we had Betty Friedan on. We had a lot of, and we had people, one man who produced avocados. I mean, it was a variety of things. I co-hosted it with a very, very well-known film critic, William Wolfe, who was an absolute dear, and the two of us co-hosted this thing, and it was called Q, because that's the name of the magazine, on J. So the cable had only got to the J channel. That's how new it was. So I'm doing this thing, and I was always very nervous and so on. And luckily, it was not live. They recorded it and then played it. And I did a few episodes of it. And all of a sudden, I'm out with my children, and I'm walking down the street to go and pick up a newspaper or something or a magazine I wanted to check out in the little newspaper shop. And there's this old guy stinking of tobacco with a cigar hanging from the end of his mouth. And he looks at me. He'd never, ever even said hello to me before. Well, he said, "I loved your show last night. You were really great." And then I'm walking on the street a few times, and always older men, and not the most savory ones, were stopping me and saying, "Oh, I saw you on TV last night. You were terrific." So I thought, well, this is very odd. Why would they be watching a magazine show? There's nothing in it for them. So the next time I had it on, I let it run. Just, I think by accident, I just let it run. And the next thing on, and remember, we didn't do porn in those days overtly. This was the nearest to porn that you could have on a cable show. It was called Blue something or other. And so all these men who were so anxious to get to this porn thing were seeing me saying, well, that's all for this week. See you again in 2 weeks. And so they all sort of saw me. And I just couldn't help laughing. I mean, it didn't insult me one bit. I just thought it was terribly funny.
Oh, talk about being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, Margaret. I want to ask you a little bit about your work in the Executive magazine, because this is so different from modeling and, well, we won't say porn because that really wasn't your industry. I'm just joking around here. But beauty and fashion, and now how did you move into working on an executive magazine? How did that come up?
Well, because I had before I got to the executive, I was really quite lucky. There were some editors in New York who were chosen by a very, very heavy-duty German publishing company, Heinrich Bauer Verlag, who they're in Hamburg and they have Skyscraper with their name on it, and it was really much bigger time than some of the other things I had done. And several editors were picked out to do some prototypes for them. And this gave me a chance to be on staff rather than, just on this freelance basis. So I took it, and I had all the fashion and beauty, and my title was Fashion Beauty Director. It involved a lot of traveling around, all location work. But the thing about it was that it was the first time that any magazine in New York was, or in the country actually, was a weekly. They were usually bi-weekly, and that's what the Germans saw as a big entry point, that they didn't have a magazine, a real magazine with fashion on location and the cooking area was all done for the magazine. So they saw this as a big opening in the American market. They also loved the fact that you could fire people in America, which at that time in Germany you could not. I'm not sure you can now.
Right.
So I did that. It was a really interesting job, very hard work. I mean, I used to have to do shoots, because it was weekly, I would have to go off, and in 10 days I'd do 5 stories a day. So I was lugging my models and clothes and accessories and fashion and, the makeup and hair people and my editors with me to, we used to go to the islands, because everybody went to the islands, like Tortola and so on. And so I thought, well, this is difficult, because when a model gets ill or you don't have enough of something or it's not quite working out, we are stuck. There's nothing we can do. So I thought, well, why not L.A.? You know, L.A. has wonderful wonderful air. And, of course, being a European, I didn't think why it wasn't L.A. And by that time, I was working with German photographers who also didn't think that. So we thought, well, L.A. is good, because there's fashion there. We can get more clothes if we need them. We can get more models if we need them, because often our models were in L.A. doing things. And so we started going to L.A. Of course, I never realized that really you're supposed to register for all of that, and neither did these fellows, and neither did the German company. So we were all over. The Germans said, oh, it's wonderful. We've got the high desert. We've got the low desert. We're all over the place. And that's because we worked very, very fast. We had to. 5 stories a day is not easy. Sometimes it was 4, but mostly 5. So we worked fast. So nobody ever questioned us. We were blissfully ignorant of the fact that the reason that people don't like to shoot there, unless they have a lot of money, is because you have to get permits and all that sort of thing. Well, we didn't know that. We had no idea. So that then led to executive publications that you were asking about. And I had the opportunity through meeting somebody, a publisher at dinner party, and he offered me the job. I was not editor-in-chief, I will say, at that time. I was slotted to be managing editor, but I wanted the idea of being in more business magazines, still focused on people. They were CEOs. We focused on CEOs. So nothing to do with money in it, because I was no good at math whatsoever. He asked if I would like to be managing editor, providing the editor-in-chief approved of me, and I was sent over to the editor-in-chief's office in California, in Orange County, actually, is where he worked from. And we went out to lunch, and I had actually broken my toes in L.A. before that, and so I'm in this sort of foot thing, and this is a friend of mine till this day, and he says, well, I just remember when I met you, and you're with this foot hobbling around, and we sat for 3 hours talking, and I had the job. And then later when he left, then I became the editor-in-chief at that time.
Okay. Wow, these are some fantastic stories. So just doing some networking, you're out there. I mean, we talk about it being old world versus new world in a way, but it's the same stuff. I mean, you had to take some risks, make some mistakes. You had to be independent and empower yourself and be confident to get out there. You had to be aware of what you could do and what where your strengths were. And certainly flexibility is huge, and creativity, and just moving around in the different spaces you were in. So I really want to thank you for sharing these stories with us, Margaret.
Well, thank you.
And unfortunately, yeah, we're going to have to wrap up. So that's our show for today. I'd like to, again, acknowledge Margaret for being our leading lady today. And a special thanks to all our listeners, as we'll be back again every Monday morning at 9 a.m. and every Friday at 2 p.m. for another Women Lead radio show. Our leading lady next week will be Moneta Plassmeyer, inventor and president of Mitano Design. The topic will be Stick With It and Patent It. I'm Joni Cannell, host of Real Life Lessons. Thank you for listening. And remember, real women are resilient, empowered, authentic, and limber.
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where life-focused, business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.